More on the myths of public-private partnerships next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principle and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Good to be back with you again today, Barry. It's always good. Our voices are getting all warmed up now. We're not quite so low as we were yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we were talking about a report that was written by the Buckeye Institute for Public Policy Solutions here in Ohio and the Reason Foundation, which is, I believe, based in New York. Both libertarian organization. Buckeye's a little bit more conservative libertarian, whereas Reason's more liberal libertarian. But what they were writing about was the potential benefits of public private partnerships, or PPPs. And they put a white paper out exposing 10 myths about public-private partnerships. Well, particularly, though, Chuck, that was done in order to soften up people for accepting governments leasing out or handing over the control of assets such as roads and bridges and other facilities, etc., into private hands in order to raise revenues. Well, Chuck, it begs a particular couple of questions. We talked about the fact that they cherry some of the questions in this, and actually by launching the white paper series with this one on transportation, I was also doing a little cherry picking, that people would normally not want to see roads and bridges have a private entity be able to set whatever fee they want to set to, well, you'd be able to go from point A to point B. But we started to get into some examples, and what we were talking about yesterday was that Indiana, about 7 years ago, I think, maybe eight now, ran into their own budget crunch, and they passed legislation in order to what they call privatize their section of the turnpike. And what they ended up doing was handing over control to, and I say control, they leased the turnpike, the Indiana Toll Road, to a private company for the term of 75 years for an upfront payment, so they would go right into their general revenue fund and balance their budget now, of $3.8 billion, with a B, billion dollars. Okay, but Chuck, if you think about that, that's really not a whole lot of money per year. And since it is a toll road, what happens is this private concessionaire, which I believe, stop me if I'm wrong, but I believe that concessionaire was a foreign country.
It's a, and I get this, a Spanish-Australian conglomerate.
There you go, Spain and Australia. Okay, that's very good. Lease now for 75 years, which means they're only about 5 or 6 years into the lease, the toll road in Indiana. Well, okay, yes, the Indiana government got a big influx of money right up front, $3.8 billion to balance a budget hole that they had. Well, why did they have a budget hole? Because they were like many other states at that time who were overspending. They were making too many promises to state employees. They were overextended by being in areas where they really have no legitimate right being, you know, running golf courses and parking garages and everything else that you would think, why is a government doing this? But the concessionaires, the Spain and Australia, get all the revenues from the tolls that come across the toll road for 75 years. And Chuck, that's a good deal for a concessionaire, because if you have a little bit of money up front in order to get a government to bite, you can actually reap quite a bit of money in the long term and with a 75-year lease.
Well, think about this, Barry. We had a $7 billion or $8 billion hole in our budget this last year, which I'm still not sure how they plugged. I frankly think it was all smoke and mirrors and basically putting off costs until the end of John Kasich's tenure as governor, which Kasich learned very well while he served in Congress. But that being said, $3.8 billion wouldn't even have halfway plugged that $8 billion hole. Now, you figure what the revenues have to be on that roadway for 75 years. Now, sure, there's upkeep costs and that kind of thing, but don't kid yourself. This Australian-Spanish conglomerate is making lots and lots and lots and lots of money on that roadway. And where's that profit going?
It's going to...
Where does the profit go?
Spain and Australia.
It's going to Spain and Australia. Now, who has the choice of who's going to maintain the infrastructure, the bridges, the asphalt, the toll booths, the facilities that you, the stop and get gas and eat facilities along a tollway. Well, it's that Australian Spanish company. And who do you think they might favor? Very often they will favor and maybe another Australian or another Spanish or another conglomerate, or maybe themselves as the people who will be the ones who will do that. And again, more revenue flows out of the country. Now, I understand the libertarian idea about free trade and all that, but I think in this case, it's being very short-sighted to begin to look at this and say, you know, it could very easily, that profit could very easily have been kept within the United States, even within the state. I'm sure there are companies that could have put together the necessary capital to lease this roadway for 75 years for $3.8 billion. It wouldn't take much for a bank to look at this and say, woohoo, look at the revenue potential on this thing.
Oh, of course.
Myth number two about they can charge unlimited tolls in PPP deals. Yeah, they're talking about there's a ceiling on the tolls and that kind of thing. I love this. There's a sentence in here that I looked at and I'm like, okay, what does that mean? I honestly don't know. It's important to note that these caps are ceilings. The actual rates a company will charge depend on market conditions. Well, that sounds like a lots of wiggle room. I mean,
it's not just lots of wiggle room, Chuck. Honestly, it's duplicitous. Okay, if you put a cap on something, that means it's not a market-driven rate. It's capped by a government, capped by regulatory policy or by contract policy. So therefore, what they're saying is, okay, the private concessionaire, there is actually a little bit of a disincentive unless the caps are set high enough to accommodate for projected future market conditions.
Well, look at this sentence below. Basically, put simply, future tolls are a policy decision and are determined by state officials upfront before a concession agreement is signed. Barry, if you'd signed a concession agreement on a toll road in 1945, which is 75 years ago, and you wanted to charge the tolls that are being collected now on the toll road, you would have been laughed out of the room.
You would have been called some kind of a profiteer, and you would have been excluded from bidding on it. That's what would happen.
So this idea that what kind of an inflation rate are they allowing for? What kind of changes in costs are they allowing for? None of that is answered by this supposed myth dispellation. I don't see any myths being dispelled at all. It looks to me like basically this company can come back to the legislature and say, we need more money. And in order to maintain the contract, I'd be willing to bet that the legislature has to take a good hard look at it and say, yeah, you probably do need more money out of that. So the idea, so they get to raise rates, but they have to go through the legislature first.
Well, and here's the whole kicker on this whole thing, Chuck. Ladies and gentlemen, we can go through all these myths individually, but I'm just going to give you kind of a general overview theme that you can use, and you can look at this paper yourself and read down through it. And if you remember the theme, you'll understand why a lot of this is not necessarily straightforward. The theme is, Chuck, that in this paper, one of the big selling points that you're trying to make is, regardless of these public-private partnerships, that the government body maintains control and ownership of the resource. They made ultimate control, and it's in myth three. And that's the key myth, and that is that, okay, you don't have to worry because government will still keep complete control, and it says in this thing, in fact, it can actually gain more control outcomes in these arrangements. Well, Chuck, yes, as I mentioned on yesterday's program, the reason why they started with transportation infrastructure is because it's very hard to make a compelling case that you should sell off road bridges and the government shouldn't have any control over those because constitutionally, Congress, we are supposed to establish post roads, et cetera, and that's kind of where our whole system came from, and that kind of is an extension of that. But now they're setting a theme for their future white papers. Well, Chuck, I think it's harder to make a good case for why government should still control or have more control over parkland or parking garages or other things for that matter that, honestly, if you start looking at it, that's where many governments get into trouble because of the upkeep and maintenance or the change in usage patterns by the public, making it obsolete. But government's still there dumping your tax dollars into it in order to keep it up and maintain it. Now, the idea for government, I know that in the city of Columbus, they do this. They have a city-owned golf course. Why should a government own a golf course? That's really beyond, because it probably doesn't make very much money for the city. And
well, golf courses are notoriously expensive to maintain.
To operate and maintain. Just,
I stopped playing golf several years ago due to back issues, but also because the cost was creeping up and golf courses were basically starting to require that you take a cart. Well, that starts to make a 18-hole $50 plus amount of money. And again, you're correct, because let's face it, here's what you have to have. You have to have a clubhouse. You have to have a club pro who sits there and maybe does lessons and runs the pro shop. You have to have groundskeepers. You have to have buildings where you maintain the vehicles. And believe me, I played at Blacklick once and got a bad golf cart and almost got killed by it. And they tried to charge me to repair the thing after somebody turned it over, trying to keep from running me over as I was walking down a path because the brakes locked up and the thing flipped with two guys in it. And they said, we're going to charge your account the $1,500 to repair the thing. And the guy says, well, the guy we almost hit says he won't sue you if you drop that. Because honestly, it was dangerous. Okay, now think about that. Is the city liable if that cart had hit me and killed one of those two guys or both of them or severely injured them?
Of course not. If it's city, then they claim sovereign immunity.
Now, of course they do, but that doesn't always work, especially in a case where it's been clear that there's been negligence and maintenance of a vehicle.
True.
Now, the reason I bring this up, it shows you that this picture is not as lily white, pretty, and simple as it looks.
Oh, no, not at all.
And this kind of thing is much better handled. I will guarantee you that that cart never would have been rented had it been a private business. But because it was the city, and because they know they have this lever, this sovereign immunity lever, they can do stuff like that.
Well,
no problem.
Let me give you another example on the other side of this with these partnerships. In my local area, the development of U.S. Route 35 has been a big deal. It's been going on for probably 25 years now, where they're trying to widen it, make it a four-lane divided U.S. highway, where it had been two lanes in many places, and especially across the river going into West Virginia. Well, the federal government and the state of West Virginia basically put money together, your tax dollars, obviously, and they started doing the improvements on U.S. 35. And they're sending it from Point Pleasant, which is just across the Ohio River near where I live, all the way down to the Taze Valley area, which is just outside of Charleston, West Virginia. So you'd have a straight corridor of four-lane interstate at 65 miles an hour to get down there, where it used to be you had to go down on a two-lane highway filled with semis at the highest rate
and tractors
at the highest rate of speed of 55 miles an hour, and then have to jump off on two other routes in order to get over to 64 to get to Charleston. Well, they started building this, Chuck, and the big problem is they ran out of money. So you have a large stretch from the Charleston corridor up and have a stretch from the Point Pleasant corridor down, but in the middle is a 14-mile gap where they didn't have the money to complete the project. Well, the state of West Virginia, they had an idea. They were working with the contract and decided they'd make an arrangement where, how about if you finish the building of the road, you provide for the cost of finishing the road, we will make it a toll road, and we will, for 35 years, hand off the profits, the tolls, to you to pay back for your initial investment. Kind of a reverse public-private partnership.
Sure.
Well, the big thing that the government of West Virginia didn't count on was the local citizenry, who rose up in force over the idea of having to pay a toll to get from one local community to another, because honestly, Chuck, that road's the main road to get up and down from areas like Winfield, West Virginia, all the way to Point Pleasant. And it's dangerous, and there have been a lot of people. It's one of the most dangerous corridors in the region. People lose their lives all the time from semi wrecks or from deer coming out in the highway or from farm equipment collisions. Yeah. It's a mess. But the public said, no, we don't want to have to pay a toll and hand money over to a private company for 35 years. We got to find another way to do this. And so, according to Bob Institute, that would be their ideal of a public-private partnership. You've already got the firm that's under contract with the state building the road originally. They just go ahead and front whatever, how many millions of dollars it would have been. And it may have been like something like 30 or 40 million more dollars to finish that 14-mile stretch of road. And then they would toll booth up at either end of the road and at all the exits. And in order to get on and off, you'd have to pay a toll. And people were chafing that to get from Point Pleasant to Charleston, it would cost them $8 each way, most likely. So they were not happy about that. And they decided that's not how they wanted to do this.
Okay, we're out of time again. So let's come back, because I have a comment to make on that. So let's come back with my comment tomorrow. We'll start off, and then we'll try to wrap this up tomorrow.
Okay, well, ladies and gentlemen, like I said, there's a lot to talk about public-private parks, and so bear with us, because we're going to try to go ahead and bring this thing home on tomorrow's program.
Join us again tomorrow for another Principles and Policies.